This is the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 26th through the 22nd. On this week's show, we celebrate the lives of six superstars, and we also discuss how a song about a ribbon has changed world history. This show goes more in depth about some of the events that we put on our daily podcast, the Music History Today podcast, which drops every single day, including weekends, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, on to this week's episode. Let's start off by talking about two Latin superstars. One had a career that spanned decades, while another one had a promising career that was cut brutally short. First to the one that spanned decades. Tito Puente was born on April 20th, 1923 in Harlem, New York. He spent most of his childhood in Spanish Harlem, which is the area on the east side of Manhattan, just above the Upper East Side. In order to calm down her hyperactive child, Tito's mother sent him to learn how to play the piano. At age 10, because of his love of jazz drummer Gene Krupa, he began to learn how to play percussion. Tito was drafted to serve in the military in 1942. He served 3 years in the U.S. Navy, serving in 9 battles during the war. When he was discharged, he took advantage of the GI Bill and enrolled at Juilliard School of Music in Manhattan. By the 1950s, Afro-Cuban and Latin jazz became popular, and Tito rode that wave. Along the way, he also put mambo and bossa nova into his repertoire. His biggest hit was Hoy Como Va, which Carlos Santana made popular with his cover version. Because he was the master of the mambo, he is mistaken for being Cuban. However, he was born to Puerto Rican working-class parents. He won many awards, including a Grammy Award, a Billboard Latin Music Lifetime Achievement Award, and his drums are actually in the Smithsonian Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. The street where he used to live in his old neighborhood, East 110th Street, was renamed Tito Puente Way, and his old post office was named after him. Plus, he was on the Who Shot Mr. Burns episode of The Simpsons TV show, so there's that. El Rey de los Timbales, and the King of Latin Music. Tito Puente, born April 20th, 1923. Next, she was the Queen of Tejano Music, the Tejano Madonna. Those are two of the many nicknames that this next artist went by. She was responsible for bringing Tejano music into the mainstream in America. Her suggestive clothing brought both admirers and detractors who said that if she wanted to be considered a role model for young women, she shouldn't dress the way that she did. Just as she was about to become a huge superstar, tragedy struck, cutting down a career that would have rivaled that of the woman who became famous for playing her in a movie about her life. Selena Quintanilla Perez, who used only her first name as her stage name, was born on April 16, 1971. In the 1980s, she fronted the band Selena y los Niños. At the time, Tejano music was strictly a male-dominated genre, and once she started winning awards for music, all that changed. She became the biggest-selling Latin artist of the 1990s. Her 1992 album, Entre a Mi Mundo, got the ball rolling. Her 1994 album, Amor Prohibido, brought Tejano music into the mainstream in America. Selena started to branch out and became an entrepreneur. She recorded an English language album, following what both Celine Dion and Shakira did to bring her true international stardom. She also started a clothing line, boutique stores, and a cosmetics line. Selena put her friend Yolanda Saldivar in charge of her fan club and then her boutique stores. And after a while, Selena's family started getting complaints from fans and customers that they weren't getting the product that they paid for. Once Selena's family investigated, they realized that Yolanda was embezzling money. Yolanda set up a meeting with Selena at a Days Inn in Corpus Christi, Texas. As the two started talking about the accusations of embezzlement, it quickly turned into an argument. During the argument, Selena grabbed Yolanda's pocketbook and emptied it out, wanting to find bank statements. In the pocketbook was Yolanda's gun. Yolanda picked it up, and as Selena tried to run out of the hotel room, Yolanda fired her gun, hitting Selena in the back. Selena struggled to make it down to the lobby where she collapsed from losing too much blood, but not before she said her final words, "Yolanda, room 158. Selena was pronounced dead a short time later. Reaction in the Latin American world was one of shock and horror. Some people who didn't follow Latin music couldn't understand why her death was such a big deal. Some people were, in fact, downright cruel and inhuman. Shock jock Howard Stern made fun of her by playing gunshots in the background of one of her songs. Class act. Selena's English album was released after her death and became a huge hit. In 1997, a movie based on her life was made starring someone who herself was on her way up to stardom at that point, Miss Jennifer Lopez. The Queen of Tejano Music, Selena, born April 16, 1991. Let's finish this segment with the first of a few major passings this week in music history. Tim Bergling was born in 1989 in Sweden. Tim decided to get into DJing due to his brother, who was already a DJ. By the time he was 18, Tim was signed to a record label. He started working under the guidance of Laidback Luke, a famous DJ and producer himself. He then struck out on his own as a producer and remixer. In 2010, at the age of 21, Tim tried to set up his social media accounts through MySpace. Remember MySpace? Those were good days. Anyway, Tim found out that his name was already taken on MySpace, and he needed a stage name, so he took the name from the Buddhist name for the lowest level of hell, Avicii, and he added an extra I to it, and the legend of Avicii was born. In 2010, Avicii released his first big hit, Seek Bromance, which went top 10 all throughout Europe. In 2011, he put out the song that most people consider to be the greatest EDM song of all time, Levels. That song went top 10 in Europe and was also nominated for a Best Dance Recording Grammy. In 2012, he and DJ and producer David Guetta put out the song Sunshine. That song was nominated also for a Best Dance Recording Grammy, Avicii's second year in a row that he got that nomination. He then tried to stop release of Leona Lewis's song Collide because it used his song Fade Into Darkness without his permission. As part of an agreement, he decided to actually produce Leona Lewis's next song, which became a huge hit on its own. As part of Avicii starting to do his festival touring, he included a memorable set at the 2012 Ultra Miami Music Festival where he debuted new songs with Madonna and Lenny Kravitz. From there, Avicii went on a roll. He was the first DJ to do a concert at Radio City Music Hall in New York City. In 2013, he released the album True. That album had the song that would turn him into an international superstar, Wake Me Up, which spent 14 weeks at the top of Billboard's dance chart. His follow-up single, Hey Brother, was almost as popular as Wake Me Up. In 2015, he released the album Stories, which he had teased at festivals all throughout 2014. Throughout the next 3 years, Avicii continued to put out music and collaborate with other artists. However, his festival and club DJing were beginning to take a toll on him, so he retired from doing them. It turns out that his mental health and stress issues went back at least as far as 2014, when he was hospitalized and had to miss his closing set at one of the Ultra Music Festivals. He would continue to fight with mental health issues until April 20th, 2018, when he took his own life while in the country of Oman. While this was a tragedy, he may have, in a very weird way, saved some people's lives by getting them to focus on their own mental health. For instance, DJs Hardwell, Sanholo, and Zhu all stopped touring for a while so that they could focus on themselves. which wasn't a bad thing and may have actually have saved their lives. The death by suicide of superstar DJ and producer Avicii on April 20th, 2018, at the age of 28. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you about our other podcast. The Music History Today podcast goes over the daily events in music history and drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. There's also the Music Halls of Fame podcast, which talks about a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other Music Halls of Fame's museums and walks of fame. The Music Halls of Fame podcast drops every Thursday and can also be found on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. Time for another passing. This man has been called the greatest musician of all time. He played at least 10 different instruments, all of them pretty well. He wrote, produced, and played all the instruments on his first few albums. His halftime performance at the Super Bowl is considered the greatest halftime performance of all time. His guitar solo to George Harrison's While My Guitar Gently Weeps during Harrison's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is considered one of the greatest live guitar solos of all time. His mixture of sexuality and religion earned him many fans while also creating a lot of, well, as one of his earliest hits was titled, controversy. In fact, then-Senator Al Gore's wife, Tipper Gore, overheard their daughter singing along to the song Darling Nikki, and that got Tipper to get Congress to start censoring songs, which started the ball rolling for albums to start getting all those parental advisory stickers that you now know, love, and, well, mostly ignore. His philanthropic work outside the public eye is just now becoming well-known. He is known as the Purple One. He is Prince. Prince Rogers Nelson, as a matter of fact. He was born on June 7, 1958, and was the product of musical parents. Prince's nickname was Skipper throughout childhood because he hated the name Prince. Prince also suffered from epilepsy when he was younger and often had seizures. The disease did not stop Prince, though, from being involved in sports, where he played, among other games, basketball. And pretty well. He also studied ballet, which definitely helped with his dancing skills in his videos and on stage. Prince's parents divorced when he was 10 years old, and the rest of his childhood was spent bouncing around back and forth between parents and new step-parents, much like children of divorce do. Prince also found himself gravitating towards music, having written his first song when he was 7 years old. He was rumored to have learned to play at least 10 instruments very well by the time he hit his 20s. By the time he was 19 years old, Prince was signed to a managerial contract, and based on the strength of his demo tape, Prince signed with Warner Brothers Records and released his first album, For You, on April 7, 1978, just 2 months shy of his 20th birthday. A little over a year later, Prince released his self-titled second album, which had the hit I Want to Be Your Lover and also Why You Want to Treat Me So Bad. In 1980, he released the album Dirty Mind, which got him into trouble with songs like Head. It also got him an opening act slot on Rick James's tour. 1981's album Controversy spawned the hit of the same name, and around this time, Prince started forming side projects like Morris Day and the Time. Prince's double album, 1999, was released in 1982 and had the top 10 hits 1999, Little Red Corvette, and Delirious. Little Red Corvette was helped by being one of only two songs from black artists that MTV was playing in heavy rotation when Little Red Corvette's music video came out, the other video being Michael Jackson's Billie Jean. Still, five albums in 5 years was only the beginning. Prince was about to become a superstar only 2 years later. After his 1999 album, Prince decided that he wanted to make a movie that was very loosely based on his life. He called the movie Purple Rain. This album for the movie was also the second album to also credit his band The Revolution, as they did help to write some of the songs. certain songs have a bit of a history. For instance, the song Let's Go Crazy is probably the best crafted song about moral ethics ever to be made. The line towards the end about how pills, thrills, and daffodils will kill is now kind of ironic, considering the way that Prince passed away. The famous drum machine intro after the organs in the beginning of the song is Prince's go-to drum machine, the Lin LM1. Take Me With You was supposed to be for his side project Apollonia 6, but instead found its way onto the Purple Rain soundtrack. Contrary to popular belief, the female voice on the song is not Apollonia, it is not Lisa, and it is not Wendy, both Lisa and Wendy from the band The Revolution. It's actually singer Jill Jones who does the honors. Computer Blue was originally a 14-minute song, but that got cut back. I'm pretty sure the original version has turned up on a special edition of the soundtrack, which you can actually get on Prince's website. Prince played all of the instruments on The Beautiful Ones and Darling Nikki, along with When Doves Cry. For Doves, he was trying to go in a different route, so he pulled the bass line out of the song. I Would Die for You, Baby I'm a Star, and Purple Rain were all actually recorded a year before the movie even came out. At a benefit concert for the Minnesota Dance Theater on August 3, 1983 at the now famous First Avenue Club that was in the movie, Prince debuted those three songs as well as his new guitarist at the time, Wendy Melvoin. The title track for the album has its own history. According to The Revolution's keyboardist, Dr. Fink, Prince wanted to write a song that sounded almost like it could have come from Bob Seger. The band Journey, though, tells a different story. According to them, Prince called them up one day and mentioned that he had written a song that sounded an awful lot like their hit song, Faithfully. He wanted their blessing, so of course they wouldn't sue him. Not only did they give him their blessing once they heard the song, but they thanked him for asking them, since a lot of bands at the time were ripping off their sound without even asking them first. And if you actually listen to Purple Rain and Faithfully back to back, you can definitely hear the similarities between the songs. Purple Rain, the album, came out on June 25, 1984 and spent 32 weeks on the Billboard Albums charts in the top 10, taking the number one spot for 24 straight weeks. Purple Rain made rumpled pirate shirts a fashion trend, along with being the basis for a famous Seinfeld episode. It also gave Prince a lot of awards, including Grammy Awards, a Golden Globe, and even an Academy Award for Best Music Score. It also is considered a classic album and one of the greatest albums ever made. In 1986, after Purple Rain, Prince started work with his group The Revolution on a couple new projects. The group was coming off a run at that point where they had put out three albums in 3 years. They had Purple Rain in 1984, followed by a tour, and then Around the World in a Day in 1985 and Parade in 1986. Parade was his soundtrack to his movie Under the Cherry Moon. They were working on a couple of new things at that time. The first was going to be an album called Dream Factory. The second was going to be just Prince himself doing an alter ego named Camille, which was actually his singing sped up and pitched a little bit higher. And then something happened along the way with doing those albums, and Prince broke up The Revolution and got a brand new band. He continued work on his new album, still using a lot of the songs that he and The Revolution had worked up. For some of the songs, he reworked the parts so that someone else could sing them. For a few, like Housequake, he kept the idea of using his Camille alter ego voice. He had so many songs that he wanted to put out a triple album called Crystal Ball. His record label Warner Brothers didn't like that idea at all, so everybody compromised and decided on putting out a double album instead. The album's title was also changed to Sign of the Times. Sign of the Times was released on March 30, 1987 in England and March 31st in America. It spawned a concert film along with three big hits, Sign of the Times, You Got the Look with Sheena Easton, and I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man. The album was a top 20 hit in 14 different countries, including America, where it hit number 6. It was the 47th biggest selling album of 1987, even though it wasn't a huge seller by superstar standards. It sold just over 1 million copies, but not much more, probably because it was a double album and thus priced much more than your standard LP record. A lot of critics consider it Prince's best work, actually. I'm still partial towards Purple Rain, such as it is. After the success of Sign of the Times, Prince created new backup groups like the New Power Generation, another movie called Graffiti Bridge, a couple more albums that did pretty well, like Love Sexy, the soundtrack to Graffiti Bridge, along with the soundtrack to Tim Burton's 1989 Batman movie. Still the best Batman movie, not gonna lie. In the mid-1990s, Prince had very public fights with his record company, with him first going by his now famous symbol as his name, and then he left his record label, Warner Brothers, altogether and started his own record label. Eventually, he went back to Warner Brothers, but it took a while, a very long while. The 20th century was when Prince was a hit-making machine, and while he still put out albums, they weren't anywhere as popular as his albums were in pre-2000, we'll say. However, as the new century began, Prince became one of the most respected musicians, along with revered status in the industry as a legend. His 2007 halftime show at the Super Bowl, complete with rain actually coming down while he played the song Purple Rain, is considered the greatest halftime show of all time. During his surprise appearance at the 2015 Grammy Awards to present the Best Album Grammy, he was treated to an extra-long standing ovation and cheers by his peers. He also had that blistering guitar solo that has gone down in history as one of the greatest live guitar solos ever during George Harrison's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. One last thing, though, that you may not have realized about Prince was that even though he was a fashion icon, that cane that he stylishly walked around with wasn't there for the look. Prince injured his hip from all that jumping he used to do on stage. He had surgery to repair his hip and had started taking painkillers to deal with the pain. As with a lot of people, he ended up getting addicted to the pills and put his health in complete jeopardy. On April 15th, 2016, Prince was taken to a hospital in Illinois after his private plane that he was on was diverted due to him becoming unconscious while on the plane. Once released, he went back home to his mansion, Paisley Park Studios, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He spent the first few days going around town seeing a jazz performance, among many other things. But on April 22, 2016, Prince was supposed to see Dr. Howard Kornfeld, who specialized in painkiller addictions, in order to have a physical exam. On the morning of April 21, 2016, Dr. Kornfeld's son came by Paisley Park in order to give Prince the drug buprenorphine, which aids in opioid addiction withdrawal symptoms. By the time the doctor's son reached the house in the morning, Prince was found unresponsive in his elevator at Paisley Park. It was the doctor's son who made the frantic phone call to emergency authorities at 9:43 in the morning. Even though the ambulance got there in less than 10 minutes, they still couldn't bring Prince back because Prince had been dead in the elevator for at least 6 hours. Prince was pronounced officially dead at 10:07 a.m. The official cause of death was an overdose of the painkiller fentanyl, which he was taking to deal with the hip pain. During an investigation into his death, authorities discovered that the fentanyl tablets were disguised as a generic form of the drug hydrocodone. Even though no criminal charges were ever brought concerning the illegal drugs, Prince's death, along with Tom Petty's death from painkillers in 2017, would help to put a very public face on the dangers of painkiller addiction, especially concerning fentanyl and opioids. Prince's ashes are on display in an urn in the atrium of Paisley Park, which is now a museum, along with still being a recording studio. In his lifetime, Prince released 42 studio albums. Of those, 15 hit the top 10, with 4 of those hitting number 1. Prince also released 106 singles. Of those, 19 hit the top 10, with 5 of those hitting number 1. Prince was nominated for 32 Grammy Awards, winning 7 of them, 12 MTV Video Music Awards, winning 4 of those, 2 Golden Globe Awards, winning 1 of those, and 1 Academy Award, winning it for the Best Film Score for Purple Rain. In total, he was nominated for 163 awards with 32 wins. He is ranked 27th on Rolling Stone magazine's list of greatest artists of all time. He sold over 150 million albums. He's had albums put into the Library of Congress National Recording Registry, and he's also been inducted into at least 6 different halls of fame. Prince Rogers Nelson, or as his friends called him back in the day, Skipper, passed away from an opioid overdose on April 21st, 2016, at the age of 57. Time for some honorable mentions for the week. First up, Dick Clark was born on November 30th, 1929. He started out as a mailroom worker at WRUN-AM radio station, but moved from the mailroom to doing weather updates and station breaks. He soon ended up at WKTV station in Utica, New York, where he hosted a country music show called Cactus Dick and the Santa Fe Riders. In 1952, Clark went back to radio to work in Philadelphia as a disc jockey. The local TV station WFIL had a music show called Bob Horn's Bandstand. Clark would first be a substitute host on the show, then the permanent host in 1956 when Horn was arrested for drunk driving. In 1957, the TV station's network, ABC, liked Dick Clark and his show so much that they put the show on nationally, and they called it American Bandstand. Clark appealed to both teenagers and adults, which made him very popular. The show routinely had 20 million viewers during its Saturday night run. Then it went to a weekday run, and then once a week on Saturday mornings, mainly Saturday afternoons, technically. Many acts also made their TV debuts on the show, and he is credited with helping to create a youth culture in America and for helping to make rock and roll popular, especially with parents. His activities of trading publicity for a share of songwriting credits and other forms of payment caught the eye of the United States Congress, who opened up payola investigations on both him and influential Cleveland disc jockey Alan Freed. Clark cooperated with the investigation and then had to give up his positions in music publishing firms. We'll go more over the payola investigations on a later podcast. From there, Clark started his own production company, Dick Clark Productions. Among the popular shows he helped to produce and host were the $25,000 Pyramid, TV's Bloopers and Practical Jokes, the American Music Awards, and of course, New Year's Eve wouldn't be the same without Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve. Dick Clark's youthful appearance and his appeal on American Bandstand earned him the nickname America's Oldest Teenager. His stroke in 2004 would limit his hosting duties. His last television appearance would be on his New Year's Eve show at the beginning of 2012. On April 18, 2012, Dick Clark passed away from a heart attack after having prostate surgery. For his influence on rock music and for helping to break major acts on television, Dick Clark was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993. Dick Clark, America's oldest teenager, passed away on April 18, 2012, at the age of 82. Nina Simone, born Eunice Kathleen Wayman in 1933, was a force of nature who defied easy categorization. A classically trained pianist, a soulful singer, a passionate civil rights activist, Simone poured her multifaceted talents into music that resonated deeply with audiences worldwide. Born into a poor family in North Carolina, Simone's musical gift was evident from a young age. By the age of 3, she was already playing piano by ear. Despite facing racial discrimination, even at her early recitals, Simone persevered, earning a scholarship to the prestigious Juilliard School in New York City. However, her dreams of becoming a classical concert pianist were shattered by the racism that she encountered at the institution. This experience fueled a shift in direction. Simone began performing in nightclubs, adopting the stage name Nina Simone. Her repertoire expanded beyond classical, incorporating jazz, blues, and folk influences. Her powerful vocals, emotionally charged delivery, and improvisational piano skills captivated audiences. Songs like I Loves You, Porgy, and My Baby Just Cares for Me became early hits. Yet, Simone was more than just a captivating performer. The civil rights movement of the 1960s deeply affected her. Songs like Mississippi Goddamn and Nina's cover version of Billie Holiday's signature song, Strange Fruit, a haunting ballad about lynching back in the day, became anthems of the era. Simone's music became a powerful tool for protest, reflecting the anger, sorrow, and resistance of the black community. However, her activism came at a cost. Simone's career faced setbacks due to her outspoken nature. She clashed with her manager and eventually left the United States, living a very nomadic life in Europe and Africa. Despite personal struggles, Simone continued to create music that explored themes of love, loss, and identity. Nina Simone's legacy is complex and extremely enduring. She was a musical innovator who blurred the genre lines, which was not very popular back then. Her music transcended both race and nationality, speaking to the universal human experience. But she was also a fighter. She was a voice for the voiceless who used her platform to challenge injustice everywhere. Even today, her music continues to inspire and empower, a testament to the extraordinary life of a woman who refused to be defined. Nina Simone passed away from cancer on April 21, 2003, at the age of 70. On January 17, 1976, actors John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd sang a blues song dressed in bee costumes for a skit for Saturday Night Live, the TV show. During the summer hiatus from the show, Belushi went to Eugene, Oregon to film the movie Animal House. There, he met and became friends with blues man Curtis Salgado. It was then that the wheels started turning on a skit that would turn into a cultural phenomenon at that time. On April 22, 1978, the culmination of that idea came to be when Belushi and Aykroyd first appeared as Jake and Elwood Blues, complete with dark sunglasses, dark suits, skinny ties, and hats. The sketch became a big hit, and that led to an album called Briefcase Full of Blues, which had two big hits on it, Soul Man and Rubber Biscuit. It would also lead to a hit movie that was released in 1980 and a less-than-good sequel years later, this time with John Belushi's brother, actor Jim Belushi, as John had passed away from a drug overdose years earlier. The group that started as a Saturday Night Live sketch and became a pop culture hit, the Blues Brothers, who first appeared on April 22nd, 1978. Last, a quick mention about something that has affected music both on stage and off stage, especially in the backstage area. On April 20th, 1971, 5 teenagers in San Rafael High School in California coined the phrase that would become code for marijuana, 420. That's all I'm going to say about it. There you go. Now you know. On April 21st, 1973, the song Tie a Yellow Ribbon by Tony Orlando and Dawn hit number one on the Billboard Singles Chart. The song has made a couple of greatest songs of all time lists. I suspect it's not because the song itself is great. The basis of the lyrics is someone telling a loved one to tie a yellow ribbon round an old oak tree because he's been gone for 3 long years. And if he gets home and he doesn't see the ribbon, then he'll figure the relationship's over. To me, that's sort of average 70s dribble, you know. Rather, I think the reason why it's made those greatest hits lists is probably due to how the song itself has actually been used throughout pop culture, especially in times of distress. The first known time that it was used was back in the late 1970s. In 1979, followers of the exiled Muslim leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, forced the Shah of Iran, who was, by some accounts, pretty brutal with his treatment of his own people, well, they forced him from power. The Shah fled to the United States, who had been backing his regime, which was pretty corrupt at that point. On November 9, 1979, students, no doubt with the Ayatollah's blessing, stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Iran, taking hostages along the way. The students did it in part to demand for the Shah's return to face charges. For the record, though, the Shah never returned to Iran. He received cancer treatment in the United States and then received asylum in Egypt, where he passed away in 1980. The hostages were held in captivity for over a year at the United States Embassy. It was also a presidential election year. Ronald Reagan used then-President Jimmy Carter's perceived lack of resolve in getting the hostages released to his advantage, winning in a landslide victory. During this time, Tony Orlando's song started getting played again, and in memory of the hostages, people started putting yellow ribbons on their trees as a show of support and to show national unity. Strangely, in a twist of irony, what forced the hostages to be released wasn't Ronald Reagan's tough talk, and it definitely wasn't Jimmy Carter's lack of negotiating skills. It was actually Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. See, in late 1980, Hussein decided that he wanted Iran's rich oil field, so he naturally invaded the country. And that was the start of the Iran-Iraq War. Iran decided that the invasion rightly took precedence over international pressure to release the hostages, so they cut a deal. The hostages were released on American Inauguration Day, January 20, 1981, just after Ronald Reagan took the oath of office, allowing Reagan to make the announcement to the nation as president, as opposed to Jimmy Carter. Reagan used it as a show of strength and his tough talk, but in reality, the timing was really just a big FU to Carter by the Iranians because, you know, politics, what are you going to do? Both the song and the yellow ribbon symbolism have been used more than a few times since then. It was used, for instance, in the Philippines in 1983 by the People Power Revolution when they tied yellow ribbons as a symbol while they were demanding the return of exiled opposition leader Benigno Aquino. Unfortunately, Aquino was assassinated literally the second he returned to the Philippines. As he descended the stairway of his airplane, gunmen sent by his political rival, then Prime Minister Ferdinand Marcos, whose wife was the shoe-loving Imelda Marcos with the amazing 1,000-shoe collection, opened fire on Aquino. What followed was the overthrow of the Marcoses and the election of Aquino's widowed wife, Corazon Aquino, as the brand new Prime Minister. Both the song and the ribbons were also used by protesters during the people protests in Hong Kong in 2014. It all started when Tony Orlando and Dawn's song, Tie a Yellow Ribbon, went to the top of the Billboard singles charts on April 21st, 1973. And that is it for the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 16th through the 22nd. Thanks for listening.